Welcome back. Say hello on Twitter, at Richard Serrett. We'll get back to my conversation with record producer and recording engineer Brooks Arthur in just a moment. And he's got some Neil Diamond stories, Van Morrison, Janis Ian, my gosh, Phil Spector. It would be quicker and easier to put together a list of people that Brooks hasn't worked with. We'll get back to that in a moment. A very big flaming object was spotted spiraling through the sky in Cambridgeshire, England this week, leaving onlookers dumbfounded. And you can read more about this story in the news section, where Sean Latasore, our webmaster, has posted that up at coasttocoastam.com. All right, back to my conversation with Brooks Arthur. We'll also open up the phone lines at the bottom of the hour, take questions and comments right here on Coast to Coast AM. And we are back with Brooks Arthur, recording engineer, Grammy Award winning record producer. Brooks, I know you wanted to, there was another Dixie Cup story you wanted to tell about going to the chapel.
It's a quick ending to the quick story. The producers weren't very happy. That's Jeff Barry and Ellie Greenwich, Jerry Lieber and Mike Sola. Weren't very happy with the way the girls were singing the little riff going out at the end. Yeah, yeah. And Ellie Greenwich, who's a great, great singer in her own right, said, "Let me give it a tug." She ran outside, and we played the track through the phones for her to overdub her voice. And she went, yeah. Boom. In the can it went, 100%. And we had gold. So I couldn't leave Chapel of Love without going to the ending and end the story. I hope
you know this. All this inside baseball stuff is so cool for those of us, as I mentioned earlier, that these songs are the soundtracks of our lives. And this, all these little nuggets that you're giving us, I think you appreciate how much it means to us. But I'm not sure, but it really does. I wanted to talk about. You were at Mira Sound. You were an independent engineer there. And then one day you're lured away by Phil Spector. How did that happen?
I had done a session with Phil with a group called The Crystals. And the record actually it never came out as The Crystals. I think it came out with another group. But it was one of the greatest sounding records I've ever been associated with. And for some reason, Phil didn't feel like... the lead was magical. So we were talking one night, and Phil said, "You know, this is Phil Spector saying, "You know, they're talking a lot about you over at A&R Studios. You should get over there and maybe make a deal." And the next night, it was maybe 2 or 3 in the morning, I was mixing a record by myself, and I just felt a body behind me. I felt a human being in the control room with me, and I turned around. It was Phil Ramone, who said to me, "I've been hearing you've been making a lot of noise around here, a lot of good noise. Why don't you make some of that good noise over at my joint and join us?" And I felt, well, if two Phils are muscling me to go to A&R, something good must be happening. And I loved that studio, and I loved Phil Ramone's work, envied his work so much. And to make a long story very, very short, they took a full page out, something about the fact that Brooks has now joined A&R and he's part of the team. And it was like you said, Richard, it was like baseball nuggets. You know, I'm talking about baseball nuggets here, you know. that's the big story.
Right. Now, Phil Spector, did you get to see that sort of eccentric, maybe even volatile side? You know, there are legendary stories about him pulling a gun on John Lennon during the, I guess it was the Imagine sessions. Did you see any of that?
Never saw guns, never heard guns, but I did marvel at his eccentricity, his clothes. He looked like he was from another time and place. And he had impeccable songwriting and arranging capabilities. And he would double and triple the piano, double and triple guitars, and have two drummers, two bass players, and they'd all be playing at one time, the same chart at one time. And it just became a bigger wall, and suddenly it's a wall of sound when he adds the strings and horns. And then when he adds the background vocals, to the strings and horns, and he melds them right into the spot where they're not noticeable, but they're almost like they're invisible. It's like wallpaper, and that sound just permeates and fills the room up. And when we played back, I went, "Mama said before I'm grown, find somebody I can call my own." When the chorus hit, boom, "and I wonder who he'll be." When that wall hit, man, it made me feel so high. I got goosebumps on my arm because not only does Phil have the magic to cut his West Coast hits, he's got a surrogate engineer who knows how to make his sound as well. So I felt like $1 million bucks. And that's the way I looked at him. I looked at him as a major talent. Talked funny. Talked like Ahmet Erdogan. Ahmet Erdogan was at one point the owner and A&R man at Atlantic Records. His dad was a Turkish diplomat. Anyway, Ahmet Erdogan would say, "Man, I love the way that music sounds, man." And you'd hear Phil say, "Man, I love the way that music sounds, man." You couldn't tell who was who, you know. Anyway.
When you were at A&R Studios, you started working with Neil Diamond, and we played a couple of Neil Diamond tracks, Sweet Caroline, of course, I'm a Believer. Was it Kentucky Woman that you worked on with Neil?
I worked on I'm a Believer, Kentucky Woman, and Sweet Caroline, but it's all like a continuum. It's a part of a story. Can I share it with you?
Please do. Please do. I'm all ears.
Okay. You got good ears. Anyway, Jeff Barry was producing Neil. Jeff and Ellie were producing Neil at A&R, Studio B at 112 West 48th Street. Jeff got a call from Don Kirshner that the Monkees were up for a recording and could he get a song to them. And Neil was working on a song. We were recording the song called I'm a Believer for Bang Records, Burt Burns' label. And we finished the record, and Burt came in and heard it and said, "I love it." And Jeff interrupted Burt's accolades by saying, "I gave the song to the Monkees. They want to record this, and Donnie Kirshner just called us." And Burt walked out very upset. And Neil said, I'll write you another hit. Don't worry about it. I'll find a song. I'll make it up for you." He said, "No, I want a song now." He said, "Well, I got Shiloh." And he said, I love Shiloh, but I don't love it as a follow-up to your hit records." So Neil went home and wrote Kentucky Woman. Burt was PO'd it for a long, long time, but went along with it. The song came out. It was a hit. I'm a Believer was a smash for the Monkees. And 20, 25 years later, the our Neil Diamond version of it, of I'm a Believer, came out and was a very, very, very notable record and was loved by people because it had that 1968 vibe, or 67 vibe with it. And so we took some. It was a psychiatry lesson, so to speak. Richard, Burt Burns mad at Neil for not wanting to back him on I'm a Believer. Jeff giving the song away to Don Kirshner for the Monkees, and Shiloh. The story of Shiloh was not quite what Neil thought, though he loved the song, loved everything Neil wrote and did, but just didn't follow up on the flow of hit-making radio, or hit-sounding radio. And then, Kentucky Woman, whoa-oh, you got to move me. Anyway, pardon my singing, guys. I used to have a voice.
Right, right.
It got rusty over the years.
It's not bad. It's not bad, my friend. How was Neil to work with? He seems like such a genuine, down-to-earth a person. What was he like to work with?
He's a breeze. And simple to record. Steps up to the plate. Takes his swings, asks how we're going to do it in the remix and the balance, seems happy with it, and then leaves and comes back a day later or 2 days later, see what kind of progress we've made, if any, and makes a couple of fixes here or there, suggests this or that, and get it out the door, get it into the store and onto the radio. That's Neil, but he's tremendously focused.
I have to talk to you about Van Morrison because he is my favorite artist, and this is kind of the way you and I met. I had played some Van Morrison music for Bumper Music on Coast. You heard it. A couple of weeks later, I get this package in the mail, and it's the reissue of Astral Weeks, one of the seminal albums of all time. And you introduced yourself as the recording engineer on the album. And then we struck up a telephone correspondence, and here we are today. But so what? It was at A&R you started working with Van on, I guess it was his debut album after he had left them, right? It was Blowing Your Mind.
He left them, and he started recording for Burt Burns on Bang Records with called Blowing Your Mind, which included Brown Eyed Girl.
And sure.
And another great song that I love called Row, Row, Rosie.
Van seems kind of temperamental. Is he as prickly as he seems?
I understand your question. It's not the first time I've heard the question. Nobody's asked me personally, but I've heard it asked of others. But I found a groove going with Van. We sort of were simpatico and read each other's mind. We didn't do much talking. We talked with our eyes about the music, about what he's hearing, and the balance of the music and his vocal sound and his grit. He was a singer that I identified with and a vocal sound that I identified with. Had I been born a little later, I might have had that sound. So I was taking 1950s and early 1960s examples and superimposing them onto the Van Morrison vocal sound and musical sound. I didn't have much to do with the arrangements of all Gary Sherman or Burt Burns. I had all to do with his singing, his performance. That was my gig. And Burt noticed that Van would gravitate to me and stand next to me on the playbacks, and he saw that we had a lot in common, and they would talk through me to him, because Van was pretty much a solid solitary. I shouldn't say that because it's Neil Diamond's title. Van was a man of solitude, even on the playback, and he would be talking to himself. Classic example of the Blowing Your Mind album is that when we did Brown Eyed Girl, we also did a song called T.B. Sheets, which he relates the story of one of his friends, be it a girlfriend or a boyfriend. And when he finished, when he did his vocal in the vocal booth with the track, he was exhausted. And he just clumped down into the middle of the control room. I mean, I'm sorry, guys. He felt in a heap in the vocal booth, and everybody was looking for Van. Where did he go? Did he go to the men's room? Did he go outside for smoke? Is he angry at us? Did he go somewhere? And I said, wait a second, I know exactly where he is, because I was witnessing his post-TB Sheets performance, and I knew that he was out of steam. I knew that he was out of breath. I knew that he was, like, almost faint, like fainting. And I went out there, knocked on his vocal booth door, walked in, helped pick him up, brought him back to his feet, and gave him a glass of water in the control room, and he sat in our chairs, and regained his composure, and he gave us all, gave everything he gave. He outdid himself. He gave every grain of Van into this song called TB Sheets, and gave every grain of Van and the other side of the happiness side in the Brown Eyed Girl and Row, Row, Rosie and those kinds of tunes. Does that answer some of your question, I hope?
Oh, yes. Yes. No, this is wonderful insights. Believe me, I'm just lapping it up as a huge Van the Man fan. And later, of course, you worked, I mentioned Astral Weeks, which I think has to be up there with...
I'm sorry, interrupt.
Yeah, we've got a couple minutes before the break. Let's, yeah, please. Yeah, go ahead, Brooks.
I'm trying to think of what I was saying.
Astral Weeks, you had a story?
Yeah, well, the story was Burt Burns and Bang Records and Van had a parting of the ways. To make a long story very short, I had left A&R Studios and built my own studio called Century Sound on West 52nd Street. And that's where we recorded Blow On Your Mind. We recorded Astral Weeks. And I was very surprised to see that Van, and very honored to see that Van followed me from A&R to Century Sound Studios, because he was in the middle of a business brawl with Burt Burns, which they somehow finally did work out later in later years. But at that particular moment, to see Van walk up the steps of Century Sound with his guitar and with his jazz ensemble to my room made me feel so honored that without saying a word, he chose me to continue with him. And that was one of the honors of honors. And what he had under his arm in that guitar case was Astral Weeks.
And it was kind of a concept album. Did you have any idea what he was trying to do with that album?
I think it was like a jazz escape. He wanted to have some jazz artists playing his music, but he wanted it to still stink a little bit from a little amateurish. A little unpolished, or a lot unpolished. A key example would be Richard Davis's bass playing, his acoustic bass, which is a monster playing bass. He's a monster. But he would tune it in such a way that it was just cheating on the left side of perfect intonation. So it felt like not slick. And I think what he did with Astral Weeks was what we came down with, and I'll say this to you because it happened to me once or twice more in my recorded life, where we started on the project, the musicians and Van, and we sort of like levitated off of 52nd Street into the sky, into the clouds. I'm not making this up. This is this is what I experienced. And when we were done with the recordings, with the tracks, we settled back down into our control room to listen. So we had, it was like an out-of-body experience with...
Well, that makes sense. You were on the astral plane. Welcome back to Coast to Coast. Richard Serrett coming to you from, well, my little home studio just north of Toronto. What a delight to have Brooks Arthur with us. And Brooks, I'd like to keep you all to myself and talk to the wee hours, but we've got people lined up to call to ask you things. But I wanted to... very quickly ask you a little bit more about Astral Weeks. And before we do that, Mike back in studio, could we just hear a smattering of Astral Weeks? There he is, the Bard of Belfast, Astral Weeks. That has to be one of the great albums of all time. It's right up there with Pet Sounds, Sgt. Pepper, Odyssey and Oracle, and Astral Weeks. And Brooks, in all honesty, I mean, that's one of my prized possessions. When you sent me the reissue of that CD, and we hear your voice on the CD because you slate in, right? Is that the proper term, slating?
That's
in
the correct term, slating on take six or take five, rolling on five. Yeah,
right. Now did the slate in, did that appear on the original recording?
No,
just on the reissue.
Just on the reissue. I just wanted to tell you that you played. I know. Astral Weeks is one of those albums, along with Pet Sounds and Sgt. Pepper. I'm so lucky to be a part of it. It just came my way. It's not, I didn't plan it, but it just came my way, so I was lucky that way. And we had that great out-of-body experience, and I had a similar experience at 914 Studios in Rockland County, which was another one of my studios, with Janice Ian. When we did it 17, we had another Astral Weeks out of body experiences, and for a third time, three times the charm, we did that I swear to you, these are not, I'm not making this up. I had that happen when Bruce Springsteen used my studio for the first three albums that he did, which now has a landmark, a historic landmark on it in Blauville, New York. But and Janis, by the way, was the first guest on Saturday Night Live. I was making little notes to myself so I wouldn't miss answering all your questions, you know, and since we have a short time to go. But Astral Weeks did bring us together, Richard.
Well, thank God for that.
Yeah.
Let's go to the phones, because otherwise I'm just going to monopolize your time. Let's go to the wild card line. Rob is in Pennsylvania. Rob, good morning. Welcome to Coast AM.
Hey, Richard. Glad to see you. I got a question for Brooke. On the microphone thing, I'm kind of a bluegrass connoisseur, so my favorite band uses a big old microphone from the 1950s, and they sound absolutely great. And I'd like his take on that.
Do you know what kind of microphone it is?
I have no idea. I know it's great big, and they all gather around, and they sound better than
Was it an RCA 44? Like the Grand Ole Opry House used to use, and Hank Williams?
Yeah. It was a big one.
It's a giant microphone. That was a ribbon microphone, the RCA 44 DX, I think it was called. And they had a sister microphone called the RCA 77, which you used to see broadcasters have it on their desks, like the early Johnny Carson shows would have that RCA 77 there. And so sometimes I would use an RCA 44 to record acoustic instruments like bass and acoustic guitars, because it has such a wide sound, and it was a ribbon mic, so it's a different concept internally, and it gives you a different, for lack of a better term, because it gives you a different sense, a different thrill. Yeah.
There you go, Rob. Thank you for that. Is your ear so tuned, Brooks, that you can tell what kind of a microphone someone is using just by the sound of it?
It would be awfully gutsy for me to answer that question with a yes. I don't know, but to just add some fuel to that fire, I can sometimes tell what studio the records were made in, records that I might be familiar with, or artists that I might be familiar with. I would recognize their a room sound, such as mine. I would recognize on the Springsteen albums, even though I didn't engineer them, but I set them up at my studio. And when I listen back now on the Springsteen, on Springsteen Radio, or just regular FM, or terrestrial, or Sirius XM satellite, I can tell my room, any other room, from 914, man, because that room was...
Not bad for a converted gas station.
A converted gas station, and we put cement on the floors and put rubber on the floors and re-cemented the floor again and put walls within walls. So it was like a little sound trap for everything. We couldn't hear the trucks roll by or the buses or car horns or fire engines. We're pretty well isolated and insulated. But I don't know if your fans or your listeners are getting a kick out of me babbling about 914.
Well, was Born to Run recorded at 914?
Yes, it was.
But wow, that's history.
The engineer was Louis Lahav, and his assistant engineer was Larry Alexander. And those are the two boys that I had hired, two guys that I had hired. Those were their first jobs that they ever had in the record business, was working with Bruce Springsteen. And then I utilized Larry Alexander to work with me, with Janis Ian. So, talk about it.
Wildcard line, George is in North Carolina. George, you're on the line with Brooks Arthur.
Well,
is George there? Hi, George.
Brooks, I was just asking, did you ever do any work down in Macon, Georgia, with the studios down there.
Say that again?
Did you ever do any work down in Macon, Georgia, where the Allman Brothers recorded out of Capricorn Records and stuff like that?
No, but I know those records well. They were great, but I've never worked with those guys. I don't think I've ever worked on a Capricorn record, but I believe they were distributed by Warner Brothers West Coast.
All right, George, thank you for that. Let's say hi to Mike is in Colorado on the wild card line. Mike, good morning. Welcome to Coast AM.
Good morning, Richard. I hope you're doing well considering the circumstances, and thank you so much for taking my call. Brooks, it's such an honor to speak with you. I'm personally a big fan of your work, and I put you right up there with Quincy Jones and Rod Temperton as far as producers go. So thank you for your work. I did have a quick question and a comment. So I know that you worked with Adam Sandler for a number of years, and you produced a lot of his music for his various movies and television shows, the Chanukah song. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about how that relationship kind of came together with you two and how you first met and any interesting stories about Adam Sandler. Thank you so much.
Thank you. I met in.
Great question, Mike.
I met in. We started recording on May 16th, 1993. I was introduced to Adam Sandler by his manager, Sandy Wernick, and the president, CEO, chairman of Warner Brothers Records, Mo Austin. And Mo called me and asked me if I had ever heard of Adam Sandler, and I answered him by imitating Opera Man. I said, yes, I've heard of him, you know. And they said, well, you've done a great job with Robin Williams. They complimented me on my Robin Williams comedy album successes as producer and engineer. And they said, why don't you go to the set of Coneheads and have a meeting with those guys, see if you and Adam could make an album. And I got all dressed up in a suit and tie, and there I was, the only guy in the suit and tie, and there they were, all in Coneheads costumes at Paramount Pictures. But Sandy Wernick and I were the only ones who were dressed up. The other guys were in costumes. So as the conversation went on, I took off my tie, unbuttoned my shirt. I just wanted to let them know that I was a cool guy and not to throw me out because I was a suit, you know. But we hit it off with 25 or 30 years together already. I've never known a relationship like this in my life. It's a gift from God. All I could tell you. And Adam.
Mike, back in studio, could we hear a little bit of the Hanukkah song, Mike? All right, there's a little bit of Adam Sandler and the Hanukkah song. Brooks Arthur is with us. Brooks, funny story, the other night, my wife and I were watching Sandy Wexler on Netflix, which is an Adam Sandler movie, and you called me, and I guess we were about halfway through the movie, and you called me and you said, hey, I'm in that movie. So right at the end, there you were in the boardroom scene. That was, talk about serendipity.
That was Rob Reiner, man, next to me. And I was so nervous because I'm hardly the actor, man. I can just about get through a telephone interview with you, yet alone having to be an actor next to Rob Reiner, you know. Phew. That was a tough gig, but I was
well,
glad to be asked.
All right, so Mike in Colorado wanted a. I guess you talked a little bit about Adam Sandler. What is he? And he seems like just a very down to earth, normal person with, you know, a good head on his shoulders, both feet on the ground, hasn't been consumed by Hollywood and all of that.
That's absolutely correct. He's a family man. He's very forthright, and he's very interested and concerned with all the people that he surrounds himself with in terms of making sure that their families are okay and their health is good. And these are very tricky times, and he's even more involved than usual just to make sure that he's not far away. He's only a phone call away or a visit away from all those people that hang with him and make funny with him, you know, not money, funny.
And how often would you, how often do you see Adam outside of business?
I have an office in his office. So it's and I used to have the studio in his offices, but we've just moved. So I used to see Adam up until all this started. I would see Adam two or three times a week, and before that maybe four times a week. And we'd always find some kind of musical nonsense to talk about or to get better at. And I rarely would participate in chatting about movies with him because they've got their tastes and their styles and their visions. And I don't know if my vibe would add any good stuff to them. You know, they got it going already, so I just limit my hangs and my dialogue and my discussions to the music side of the coin. I hope that answers.
Let's try to squeeze in one more call. West of the Rockies, Linda Marie is in Medford, Oregon. Linda, go ahead.
Yes, good evening, Richard. Good evening, Brooks. I'm fascinated with all your stories and your history. As it turns out, Mom and I are we're a duet, a singing duet called Sweet Talk here in Oregon. And actually, Medford, Oregon is very close to the home of Adam Sandler's Uncle Alan. And I don't think he's no longer living, though. Anyway, what I called to ask is I heard Billy Joel tell a story about how he entered an ad to be an accompanist for the Shangri-Las, and I was wondering if you would verify that story, please. And I could take my answer off the air.
They started to cut a track.
Thank you, Linda Marie.
They started to cut a track on one of the Shangs tunes. It was either Remember Walking in the Sand or Leader of the Pack. And they were cutting it at a studio called Ultrasonic on Long Island, and it wasn't panning out for them. But the piano player on those sort of demos turned out to be Billy Joel, and we kept the Billy Joel part when we recorded some of the track. And those two are monumental records. And though I don't see Billy all the time, we do have that sort of together. Wink and a nod, you on the Shang sessions. We'll never forget it. And it was noticeable.
There you go.
It was very noticeable that he was above average in terms of his style and his bandwidth, you know, his span of his hands, you know, the way he plays the chords.
Well, it's a true story then. Excellent. Well, we had you on here to confirm it. Brooke, sadly, we are out of time, but I've enjoyed this so much. I'd love to have you back on again somewhere down the road.
Somewhere down the road, and when I regain my throat.
One of these days, you know, you're a baseball nut like me. One of these days, I'm going to get out to L.A. Maybe we'll go to Chavez Ravine and watch a game together.
Wouldn't that be terrific? I'll take it to the office, too.
Fantastic. All right, Brooks, you be well, and I hope we'll talk again soon.
Stay safe, and it was an honor talking with you.
Likewise, my friend. All right, here's the boss, Bruce Springsteen, Born to Run, recorded at 914 Studios. That's Brooks Arthur's studio. All right, Preston Dennett standing by to talk UFOs right here on Coast to Coast AM.